started since it's after 4:30 here. This is the Woodway City Council budget work session. The purpose of the work session will be to discuss the 2026-2027 proposed annual budget for the city of Woodway. Representatives from the Texas Municipal League will offer a budget boot camp presentation covering the following topics: governmental accounting, debt, property taxes, municipal budgets, and legislative updates. As this is a work session, no action will be taken. I'm opening the session at 4:32 p.m. Ms. Hernandez, over to you. I'm just going to pass it straight to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor,
for doing this for us, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, sir. Happy to be here. So thank you, Mayor and Council. So we're officially in budget season, and the next few months you'll hear me use phrases like capital outlay, de minimis tax rate, and special revenue funds. So before we start throwing all kinds of numbers at you, city staff thought it would be important to provide a budget training so you will be familiar with this accounting language and be equipped to review the budget presented. So we reached out to Texas Municipal League, and Keith Dagan is here tonight to provide a condensed version of their budget boot camp. Keith is a certified public accountant with over 25 years of municipal finance experience. He is now retired, but is a boot camp wrangler with TML's City Financial Services, teaching fundamentals of governmental finance to others. So please help me in welcoming Keith Dagan.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, Council, for having me here tonight. I wanted to start off, Brenda started with the introduction. You've got this slide here. The key thing I just want you to have there is if questions come up after tonight, please feel free to reach out to me at the email you see there at any time. I'll be happy to answer your questions, either with an official TML position or personal opinion, depending on the nature of the question. I will try to distinguish if it is my own personal opinion throughout the presentation this evening. This is actually a very condensed program tonight. It's taken from a training that TML does called Boots, Budgets, and Balance Sheets. It's about 300 slides of information that we give to finance officials to help them understand what are the requirements that they are supposed to be doing throughout the year. However, this condensed version is one that we share with city councils to help orient them to financial matters. So I hope that this will serve as a budget kickoff with some concepts that you're going to be hearing a lot more about this summer. Just starting off very quickly, governmental accounting. Governments have very different needs than you do in the private sector. If you've been a council member a long time, you get this. If you're newer to city councils, it takes a little bit of a learning curve. The emphasis is on ongoing operations for a community. It's not a profit motive. So we are effectively, as governments, a nonprofit entity that has to put enough resources aside to continue to sustain ourselves going into the future. Accountability for those resources is the big key for us. And all of our reporting focuses on being able to make sure that as guardians of the city's funds, how are they being spent? What accountability do we have? And around that, we have all sorts of governmental accounting standards that have been designed strictly for cities. Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB, they are the authoritative guidance. The website here, GASB.org, they have over 100 standards that apply to governmental financial statements. And it seems like every year they add about three more that Brenda has to read and understand and incorporate into the annual audit process. As you know, city finances are organized into funds, and that's based on function and purpose, and we'll talk a little bit about those. But each fund serves as a separate, self-contained set of assets, liabilities, revenues, and expenses. Each fund operates as a separate entity while simultaneously being reported on as part of the whole government. A government can have a single fund depending on their size, or it can have hundreds of them based on the needs of the government. I tell people that cities are kind of like General Electric. If you're familiar with General Electric in the 70s and 80s, you knew them as the people who made light bulbs. They also made appliances. If you dug into their financial statements, you would also learn that they made nuclear submarines and nuclear reactors. They're a big conglomerate with a lot of different business units. That's no different from cities. Cities effectively have a lot of different business units. The police department effectively is its own business. The parks department is effectively its own business, and so on. But all of those have to come together into a single unit to prove up the accountability of how the city operates as a whole. Unfortunately, some of the buckets of money that we have can only be used for specific purposes and then therefore cannot be used for other purposes. And that's where the fund accounting comes into play, because it segregates the assets that can only be used for a single purpose, or it at least shows the restrictions on those, and we'll talk more about that as well. There's three major fund types. Governmental funds, that's going to be your general operations of the government, your everyday things that you do to provide services to the community. Your primary revenues are typically going to be things like taxes of some kind or grants. The residual of assets over liabilities is called fund balance. Now, contrast that with proprietary funds. This is going to be used for activities that are primarily supported by user fees and service charges. These are typically your utility type funds. The residual of assets over liabilities is called net position in this case. One of the things that we like to do to make what we do confusing is call the same thing by different terminology. So you have fund balance if we're talking governmental funds, and we have net position in proprietary funds, but in essence, that's the same thing. It's basically what's left and able to be spent. And we'll classify both of those even further to help understand what is available for day-to-day use. Fiduciary funds are a little bit different. This is used for resources that are held in a trustee or custodial capacity for outside parties and can't support the government's own operations. The residual of assets over liabilities is called fiduciary net position, but these kinds of funds are not common for cities, and we'll give examples of all of these here. So governmental funds are going to be things you'll see in the financial statement or the budget, your general fund, special revenue funds, debt service funds, capital project funds, or permanent funds. Your proprietary funds will be things like enterprise funds or internal service funds. Fiduciary funds are going to be things like private purpose trusts, pensions, or employee benefit trusts, things of that nature. You don't have fiduciary funds, so you don't have to worry about those. Typically, you see fiduciary funds are going to be held primarily much larger governments at the state level or a county level, typically. When you invest in a local government investment pool, that is a fiduciary fund. Your employees participate in a retirement system. That also is a fiduciary fund. But typically, you don't see that on the books of local governments. So general fund, this is your primary operating fund of the government. GASB says that we're going to use this for all of our activities by default, unless we're required to use another fund type by another terminology we have. You're going to hear commonly generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP. Or there's a legal requirement to use another fund. And then sometimes just sound financial administration dictates that we ought to go ahead and use another fund. Most transactions, though, for cities are reported in their general fund, and you can only have one general fund. Special revenue funds, these account for resources that are restricted or committed for a specific purpose other than debt service or capital projects. Restricted or committed resources have to make up a substantial portion of your revenues. Restricted, as defined by GASB, means that there is some type of external legal limitation on how you can use the funds. Some of our most common special revenue funds deal with hotel motel occupancy taxes, because the state says there are only certain ways you can use that money. Or grants. The granting agency, if they give you a grant, they want to see this being used for specific purposes. And they have the ability to take that money back, i.e. restrict it for you, if you're not using it correctly. Committed is going to be something that is self-imposed limitations by you, the governing body, not by management itself. Sometimes you'll see in some communities that things like golf funds or drainage funds, stormwater funds. Sometimes those are classified as utilities. Sometimes, though, those are classified as governmental funds because the government says we're not going to be able to make a profit on these. We're going to maintain them as governmental funds. Debt service funds, these are going to account for resources accumulated for the repayment of principal and interest on your long-term general debt. Your primary revenues here are going to be property taxes and investment income. Capital project funds, this accounts for resources that you've accumulated for major capital outlays. You can use cap project funds for repair type projects or outlays associated with new assets of some kind. It can be equipment or infrastructure. It doesn't have to be the big projects. It can be any kind of capital outlay, if you will. Your primary revenue source is going to be bond proceeds, although it is common to dedicate a portion of your tax rate or make transfers, cash transfers, to a equipment replacement fund of some kind. The permanent funds, these are not as common for cities. These account for resources that are legally restricted such that only the earnings from the fund, not the principal, can be used for the government's own purposes. And I actually noted that you do have a permanent fund on the financial statements. It's escaping my memory at the point in time, but I do know that you have kind of an endowment that was given here, I believe, for a local park.
Right, Arboretum Endowment.
Okay. Correct. So that is considered a permanent fund, if you will, where you're only going to be able to use it for that specific purpose that the donor gave that money for. A lot of times in small communities, if they have a city-run cemetery, you'll see some kind of cemetery fund to help keep up with the maintenance on those. Your enterprise funds, these account for activities that operate like a business. So this is going to be your water, wastewater, solid waste activities typically. You're permitted to use an enterprise fund if a fee is charged to external users, even if you're only going for a partial cost recovery. You're required to use an enterprise fund for these purposes when the debt is backed solely by fees or charges, there's a legal requirement to fully recover costs, or you have a management intent to fully recover the costs. Internal service funds, these also operate like a business. These account for goods or services that are going to be provided to other departments within the city. And in this case, you'll see that the budgets reflect that if a department uses these services, they pay the internal service fund. You're managing these to break even over time. Some examples of this that you'll see some cities have, maybe they'll have a fleet fund or a central warehouse fund where departments pay into that for the use of vehicles or maybe to buy goods that are stored there in a warehouse. Sometimes you'll see this as self-insurance funds as well. Measurement focus. We talked about governmental funds and proprietary funds. We said that governmental funds are your day-to-day operations. Your proprietary funds are those that kind of mirror the businesses, the private sector. Each of these kinds have a different measurement focus on how you look at the transactions. Governmental funds are going to use the current financial resources focus. You only record assets, liabilities, and other items that are relevant to near-term liquidity. Increases in your net financial position or are either called revenues or they're called other financing sources. Decreases in net financial position or expenditures or other financing uses. The proprietary funds use what we call economic resources focus. All assets, liabilities, and items are recorded, no different from a business. Increases in net financial position are going to be called revenues or gains, and then decreases are going to be expenses or losses. So again, we try to confuse matters by using different terminology for like concepts, and I apologize for that. And I have complained to the GASB for 25 plus years about how hard this is to show to your average person who is not familiar with the day-to-day workings of government. So to summarize kind of how this fits and what this would look like, in your governmental funds, things like the issuance or payment of debt are recorded as revenues, not a balance sheet change. When you purchase a capital asset, you show that as a capital outlay expenditure, and you don't record depreciation in your governmental funds. I will say that the governmental funds are recorded closest to the way that most cities actually budget for them, and that's how we record the transactions. Proprietary funds, though, issuance or payment of debt or balance sheet items. The purchase of a capital asset is a balance sheet item. You don't show that as an outlay or a revenue, depending on what you're doing, and you do record depreciation. So for someone coming in from the private sector, those proprietary funds are going to feel very familiar. Add insult to injury, we also have different basis of accounting. Mm-hmm. The governmental funds use what we call modified accrual. And in that case, we're going to recognize revenue if it's available to make payments soon after year end. And typically, we say that that's 30 days. We'll recognize expenditures if the payment is normally made during the reporting period or soon after the year end. And the practical impact is that we record transactions throughout the year on a cash basis. And then at year end, Brenda and her team make a bunch of journal entries to get everything ready for the audit and convert to that modified accrual. For our full accrual, which is our proprietary funds, we're going to recognize revenue when earned and measurable. We're going to recognize our expense when the liability is incurred. But the dirty secret is we record these, for the most part, no different from the governmental funds. There's a lot more year-end work and journal entries that have to be done. The only exception to this is typically utility billing systems are set up to record things on an accrual basis throughout the year. But pretty much everything else throughout the year is handled on a cash basis, and at year-end, journal entries are made to get all this to the appropriate basis for the auditors. We talked a little bit about fund balance earlier, as well as net position. Fund balance can be categorized several ways: non-spendable, restricted, committed, assigned, and unassigned. And the GASB tells us that each category should be disclosed by purpose on the financial statements, such as committed to public safety or committed to parks. If you have a lot of commitments and restrictions and assignments, you can find out that the equity section of the balance sheet is longer than the assets and liabilities because of all of these listings. Definitions of these: non-spendable means it can't be readily converted to cash. Some things that you'll see that fall into this category might be prepaid insurance. If you pay your insurance premium mid-year, some of the premium that you pay is going to be for next fiscal year and not all for the full fiscal year. So you would record some of that as a current year expenditure, and you would record some of that as prepaid insurance. Also, if you have inventory, that's not going to be readily converted to cash, so inventory would be showed as a non-spendable fund balance item. Restricted, we already talked about this in relation to special revenue funds, but the key with the restricted is it has to be externally enforceable limits on how those funds are used. And that can be creditors, grantors, or we mentioned the state enabling legislation already. Committed is going to take an action of the City Council that can only be rescinded by a similar action no later than the end of the reporting period. Adopting a budget alone is not enough to commit funds because a budget is going to lapse after a year. Typically, when I see somebody setting up a committed resource, we'll see that being done through the budget adoption ordinance and not the budget itself. Assigned fund balance. This is going to be something that actually does not require City Council action to be classified as assigned. Typically, this is limited to purchase orders that roll over to a new year. You determine to purchase something, it's not delivered in the fiscal year that you determined to purchase it, so it's shown as an encumbrance against next year's budget. At year end, you assign that portion of the fund balance to cover the cost of those items. Unassigned fund balance is what's left. It's the residual balance of the fund. Only the general fund can have a positive balance of unassigned. A deficit, though, in any fund is shown as negative unassigned fund balance. Net position. We have three categories of net position. And again, net position is for the business types. That's going to be net investment in capital assets, restricted and unrestricted. Net position is not broken out by purpose, just by category. Restricted and unrestricted are very similar to the government's restricted and unassigned categories. Restricted is going to be narrower than the purpose of the proprietary fund. Oftentimes you'll see this as restricted assets for debt service. Unrestricted is what's left, and any kind of proprietary fund can report unrestricted net position. That net investment of capital assets, the purpose of that is to segregate out the value of your infrastructure. Otherwise, business-type activities would have very large fund balances because of your water and sewer networks. So by segregating that out, that unrestricted portion really shows you what is spendable. You can't sell your water lines for a profit, so it doesn't make sense to show them as part of your total. That's all I have on governmental accounting. Any questions on governmental accounting before we transition to debt? Seeing none, we'll keep going. And again, you have my email at the beginning if a question is jogged later on down the road. Talking a little bit about debt, local governments have very limited authority to issue debt for public purposes, and it's to finance our capital improvements. We can issue anticipation notes or commercial paper to help with short-term financing needs, but we cannot, as local governments, issue debt to finance budget shortfalls or for ongoing operations. Contrast that to what most people associate with government debt, which is the federal deficit. The feds can borrow money all the time because they don't have a balanced budget. Cities are expected to balance the budget over time, and therefore you can have ups and downs, but the expectation is you've got to be able to pay for your services over time. Debt is not a bad thing, nor is it a good thing. It is a financing tool. Debt is going to increase the cost of a project because you have to have interest payments. But on the flip side, paying for something today in today's dollars may save you money in the long run, because nothing gets cheaper in this world. Debt can also spread out the cost of a capital improvement so that multiple generations who benefit from the asset are also paying for a portion of the improvement. If you set up a new playground today, that playground is going to be there for 15 to 20 years, most likely, before you replace the equipment. It makes sense to allow each year's residents who happen to be here to help pay for a little bit of that improvement. The kinds of debt that cities can issue, general obligation bonds or GOs. This is authorized by a vote of the citizens individually or as part of a larger bond program. It is secured by property taxes. We say consider using when the debt is going to have a significant impact on the tax rate or when the project is maybe controversial or atypical. Park improvements, certainly if you're doing something with your city hall or you're trying to build a civic center, we recommend that you take these things to the voter. Some of these things like a civic center, because it is expected to make money, have to go to the voter. Once a GO is successfully voted on, the city council can issue the bonds with no additional notices. You just take the formal actions and work with your financial advisor to issue the debt. Certificates of obligation, or COs, this is a little different because voter approval is not required, but the use of the proceeds is more limited. It is secured by property taxes, but it's also secured by a limited pledge of a second revenue stream. So even if you issue a CO just for the utility, if you read through the official document, it's going to say that it is backed by property taxes, even if you never intend to use property taxes to repay that debt. We suggest consider using these when debt is going to be minimally impacting on your tax rate, your project is normal or customary, or there may be an emergency need that exists. We see these used quite frequently for things like street programs, fire apparatus, roof repairs, water line replacements, things of that nature. It is common to see COs used for. Mechanics are a lot more complicated than GOs. First, the council has to pass a notice of intent resolution, and that has to be published in the newspaper 2 times. The first newspaper publication has to be at least 45 days prior to actual issuance of the debt. Your citizens can petition to stop the sale. And then lastly, you can't issue a CO to pay for an item that failed a GO election within the last 3 years. A CO cannot be a workaround for citizen intent. Revenue bonds. Revenue bonds are used, voter approval is not required, but the proceeds must be used for the very specific purpose of the bond. So you will see a revenue bond issued as a water revenue bond or a sewer revenue bond or something similar to that nature. It's going to be secured by a revenue stream such as utilities or sales tax. We suggest consider using this when you know your revenue is going to be sufficient to pay your debt service. The property tax rate is not impacted, and this kind of debt is not secured by property taxes. Oftentimes, we'll see this used for water or sewer plant expansions or very larger capital programs within a utility. The mechanics of these are very different because revenue bonds require that your net revenue stream, i.e. your profit of the fund, be able to cover the next year's debt payment by a fixed percentage. And usually you see that in your bond covenant saying that you're going to earn 1 to 1.5 times what next year's debt payment is supposed to be. They also require you to set aside a reserve that is typically equal to your highest annual debt service payment. Well, if you're going out to get debt, it's because you don't have the money to finance a project. So most of the time we see that in order to fund the reserve requirement, you have to issue extra debt for the reserve. And then lastly, revenue bonds have higher interest costs most typically than COs. So what I've seen is that over the years, because of all of these higher costs associated with revenue bonds, most cities have gravitated towards issuing COs instead because COs are cheaper, they're easier, and they can serve the exact same purposes. Any questions about debt? So let's get into property tax terminology. So just some basics about property tax. First and foremost, it's governed by Chapter 26 of the Texas Tax Code. Every legislative session, we see that this code and the rules are going to change anywhere from slightly to drastically. The last major change was about 6 years ago with what we still refer to as Senate Bill 2. We'll talk a little bit more about that here in a moment when we get into the legislative foreshadowing. Property tax is premised on the concept of truth in taxation. The law is set up that we want maximum transparency when you levy the tax. We want to maximize the opportunities for the public to have input and express their opinion on the process. And then lastly, state law puts explicit brakes on the process as to how much you can raise without going to the voter for a formal election. There are two components to the tax rate. Interest and sinking, or INS rate, is your debt service rate. Maintenance and operations, or M&O, is what's funding the rest of your general fund operation. So some terminology to know, and you'll get a lot of this summer, no new revenue tax rate. This raises the same amount of revenue from existing properties in theory. There's a lot of machinations on the worksheet. The worksheet has about 80 lines of input when you look at it start to finish. But the idea is that if a property was on the tax roll last year and this year, it should raise on average across all properties the same revenue. Your voter approval tax rate, it's your no new revenue M&O component multiplied by 1.035, allowing you up to 3.5% growth, plus your debt rate, plus unused increment rate. The idea of the voter approval rate is you always have to be able to pay your debt, and you look at last year's operations, and state law currently allows city councils to go up to 3.5%, which may or may not be reflective of the kind of inflationary costs that we as governments have. That unused increment rate is the foregone revenue where your adopted rate revenue was less than your voter approval revenue over the last 3 years. And what happens as part of that tax calculation, they look at how much you could have raised, how much you did raise. They'll bring that forward over a rolling 3-year period, and then they'll convert that to an unused increment based on today's values and give you a little bit of extra rate that you can use. Most cities go up to the voter approval rate every year, so they don't have to worry about an unused increment rate. The de minimis tax rate, this is for the cities under 30,000 population. This is the rate that's going to generate an additional $500,000 of new revenue. It was jokingly referred to in Austin as the fire truck exception. However, if you've ever priced a fire apparatus, you know that $500,000 typically is not going to cover those costs. But it is something that smaller cities can use for one-time capital purchases and needs where they can go above the voter approval rate or that no new revenue rate to get that one-time exception. So the tax rate adoption process, first and foremost, your appraisal district provides you some level of preliminary values. The governing body or staff will draft your budget. The property values are going to be certified, and then the designated officer is going to calculate that no new revenue rate and the voter approval rate. The governing body then proposes the rate to adopt and then holds hearings on that rate. When you propose that rate, that's not saying that you have to go that high. That just serves for all of the publication purposes. Whatever you propose, you cannot adopt anything higher. However, a lot of cities we see will propose the voter approval rate and then come back over the next several weeks and whittle down a rate to somewhere between the voter approval and the no new revenue. However, you have to propose a rate higher than what you ultimately adopt or propose what you adopt. If you propose a lower rate, you then cannot discuss and choose to adopt a higher rate somewhere through the budget process without going through the process again. Ultimately, you will determine what tax rate that it is that you want to adopt. Typically, this is early to mid-September that this process takes place. However, some key dates, July 25 is the date by law the chief appraiser is supposed to give you the appraisal roll. The designated officer then begins the process of calculating the appropriate tax rates. By August 7, or as soon as is practicable, that designated officer submits those tax rates to you, the city council. You propose a tax rate, and then notice of the tax rates goes out on your website, within the newspaper, and other avenues. After you give a public hearing notice and at least 5 days have passed, if your proposed rate exceeds the no new revenue rate, the governing body has to hold a public hearing. Only one hearing is required under the current law, and then the rate can be adopted at the conclusion of that hearing. Sometime in late August, or at least by September 30th at the latest, a rate that exceeds your voter approval rate has to be adopted 71 days before the election. September 30th is the last day to adopt a rate if it doesn't exceed the voter approval rate. And then 60% of the governing body must vote in favor if exceeding the no new revenue rate. There is a caveat that you do get 60 days after the receipt of certified tax values or later. They had to put that in because there are some areas of the state where the chief appraiser does not give certified values by July. Sometimes they come as late as August or early September. That makes it really hard for the communities in those regions. Fortunately, most chief appraisers are able to get the information in the appropriate time frame. So when does the adopted tax rate trigger an election or a petition? If it's below the voter approval rate, no election or petition is going to be required. If you want to adopt a rate that is above your voter approval but below the de minimis rate, your citizens can petition for an election. If it is above voter approval and you don't have a de minimis option, an election is going to be required. And then lastly, if you're going above both your voter approval and your de minimis rate, an election is required. And that's there at the uniform date in November. Questions on tax rates? Yes, sir.
I was curious, how did they arrive at the 3.5% rate as the max there?
They felt that that rate was closer to inflation. Prior to that, that rate was 8% that you could go up. And a lot of cities did take advantage of going higher than 3.5, but at the time they felt like 3.5 was maybe more reflective of inflationary forces that cities have to deal with. Going into budgeting, at a high level, why do you prepare a budget? First and foremost, you have to. It's required by law. Local Government Code 102 says cities have to have a budget. More importantly, though, it sets your priorities as a city council for staff and then helps staff provide accountability to you on how they're spending your resources. It also gives the authority and control for spending for each purpose or department or fund. And lastly, by setting the budget and your expense priorities, it also determines the tax rate or fee revenues that you need for the operations and then help drives the conversation on taxes and or fee structure. What must be included in the budget? Local Government Code 102 says you need an itemized comparison between expenditures in the proposed budget and the prior year. The estimated amount of money for each project or expenditure that's going to occur, line items for spending on newspaper notices and lobbying, if any, a financial statement that shows your outstanding obligations, cash on hand in each fund, all funds received during the preceding year, and all funds available for the ensuing year. Estimated revenue available to cover the proposed budget, an estimated tax rate needed to cover the proposed budget, and then anything else your charter may require. Your team here has an excellent budget. The GFOA Distinguished Budget Award is not something I see in communities this size. I typically see it in communities at least 5 times the size of your community. So that is something to be very proud of. And certainly your budget meets all of the requirements of state law in that regard. The process itself, your proposed budget needs to be filed with the city secretary at least 30 days before adoption. It needs to be posted on the city's website so it's available for the citizens to look at. You're going to hold a budget hearing at least 15 days after the budget is filed and before the date the tax levy is made. The hearing notice in the paper is between 10 and 30 days before the hearing, and you take action at the end of the hearing. Your budget adoption, you adopt after the budget hearing, but before the tax rate adoption. And there is a nuance where you have this separate ratification vote if you raise more property tax revenue than the prior year. So it's kind of a threefold thing. You adopt the budget, you ratify the tax increase, and then lastly, you adopt your tax rate as part of the evening's process. Any questions on budgeting? Last, Brenda just asked me to talk a little bit about some of the financial challenges the cities face and start taking a preview at the legislative cycle. I think we've heard a lot about this lately in the news, but the annual audit, Local Government Code 103, requires all cities to have an audit. It is to be completed within 180 days of the fiscal year end. So that is March 28 for the September 30 year ends. If a government does not complete the audit, the Attorney General can then find the city as non-compliant. Seen a lot of headlines lately that the Attorney General's office did a mass request of all cities to find out if they were compliant and just did an open records request to get the information to know whether they were compliant or not. A non-compliant city cannot adopt a tax rate above the no new revenue rate for the tax year starting after being declared non-compliant and any tax year that starts before compliance is achieved. The law for 180 days has been on the books since about 2007, give or take. Prior to that, cities actually had a shorter time period. They had 120 days. A couple big cities were struggling with the deadline and said, could we have a little more time? I'll also say that when they moved from 120 days to 180 days, that we were at GASB standard roughly 45. We're now at GASB standard roughly 105, so we've had 60 additional standards, so a lot of cities are pushing that deadline a little bit more. So this is something that is very tough, but it is also something that is very politically charged, because we see the press releases that are coming out from Austin saying that these cities, 130 cities, are non-compliant and therefore can't raise taxes. This is something that a lot of smaller communities struggle with. There are a lot of communities that audit firms will put at the back of the line, and then they will service by the deadline those cities that are larger. You have a good audit firm, fortunately, that looks at cities of all sizes. But this is always something to keep in the back of the mind, is that that audit has to be done within that 180-day window for you to have the flexibility to make your own decisions as it relates to the property tax. Revenue limits. Mentioned this already, but the property tax calculations limit increases to 3.5% annually. That's across all properties that were on the tax roll in both years. Recent law over the last couple of years, I don't remember the exact year, but they changed it up to where if you've got a telecommunication provider who bundles cable and telecom services, they don't have to pay you the lower of the two calculated franchise fees. And they can send you a letter and say, this year cable is lower, therefore we're not going to pay you the cable bill. We'll only pay you the telecom bill. But for a lot of cities, that was a six-figure plus hit. Many revenues, such as hotel occupancy taxes, have limited uses. So I've worked with some communities that hotel occupancy tax revenue is their number one revenue source because they are a destination city. And because of the limits in how they can use it, they can't use it for their general operations, and they're kind of stuck, if you will. Lastly, and I think also very important, that state law doesn't give us any relief for any of these things if we have economic downturns. It's been a long time since we've had an economic downturn. We have a lot of folks who are new to the finance business in governments that haven't really experienced that. We had a little hiccup in COVID, if you will, but we haven't seen something like the Great Recession back in 2007, 8, or 9 in many folks' careers. There's always kind of this assumption that property tax values are going to continue to go up, but I do remember a time in my career when they seesawed both directions. So some potential topics for the 2027 legislation. The Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker of the House have issued their interim charges, and typically what we see is if they want to study something in the off year, we're going to see proposed legislation in the legislative year. The governor has not issued any kind of charges. However, as part of his campaign reelection strategy, he issued some stuff as well. But some things that he's looking at, the governor would love to limit local spending to the lesser of 3.5% or a combination of population growth and inflation. The other thing I think that we're really kind of looking at very closely is the idea that it would take two-thirds voter approval for tax increases. And how that is defined, would that be if you choose to go over your voter approval rate and go to your voters, or would that be for any kind of tax increase? We're not sure. The devil will be in the details with this. Another suggestion that he's called for is that 15% of voters can petition a tax rollback election. If your citizens are not happy with your tax rate and enough of them sign a petition, they could force you to lower it even if you are being prudent with their resources. Limit appraisals to every 5 years. Right now, a property is going to be appraised at least every 3 years, but he would like to see that changed every 5 years. The other thing is right now we have an appraisal cap that says that a home can only go up 10% in value for taxable purposes every year. He would like to see that lowered to 3%, which would make it even harder for our tax base to grow and keep up with inflationary forces. The Lieutenant Governor, he would like to lower the age of eligibility for the senior exemption and any kind of senior tax ceiling from 65 to 55. For some communities, that can make a significant impact if they have an aging population who aren't quite there yet. He would also like to evaluate local government fees such as permits and utility connections to ensure transparency and accountability. There's even talk of potential for separate audits for some of these fees maybe being required. The other thing is he wants to study the collection of the hotel occupancy taxes to make sure that that process works and that the money is being spent according to the state's purposes. The Speaker of the House wants to examine local government spending and debt practices, including your other revenue sources, and figure out how to limit the growth of local spending. But I see at least in two of the three here, limit local spending. And unfortunately for us in this business, oftentimes our legislators propose what they believe are really great ideas, but they don't always understand the mechanics of how we operate and the needs that we have. And I appreciate that you as city councils should have the flexibility to make the decisions that are best for your community and not have a top-down dictation of what we can and can't do. I think that's how the system is really designed to work. We may get several proposals come out of this. We may get none. We just don't know. But every year we see that the legislators look at us as kind of the bad guys, if you will, and point fingers at us for how we manage our money without looking always internally at how they use their resources as well. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, and it's only going to make our jobs a little bit tougher as we go. Certainly, TML is a resource throughout the legislative session to monitor what's going on, provide feedback on the things that could be considered harmful, and give heads ups on things that you may want to talk to your local elected representatives and share your concerns or support of various proposals that might be coming within the next 6 months to a year. Just quickly mention some resources that TML can provide. First and foremost, TML has a lot of stuff on their website, including publications on economic development, municipal procurement laws, types of Texas cities, and website posting requirements. TML does multiple trainings throughout the year, Public Funds Investment Act, Budget and Tax Rate Workshop, and as I mentioned earlier, the Boots Budgets and Balance Sheets Workshop as well. Government Finance Officers Association of Texas, they do spring and fall conferences for finance officials, as well as a budget academy, and hold regional meetings throughout the year. TML City Financial Services, which is myself and the team that I work with, Boot Camp. It is Wranglers being dispatched to the community for hands-on training and support. I know we'll continue to support Brenda throughout this budget cycle, but appreciate the opportunity to come and kind of give an overview this evening on some basic finance topics. And then if anyone is very interested in more of the nitty-gritty for this, we do offer the full workshop multiple times throughout the year across the state. In fact, I'm kicking one of these off tomorrow morning in Austin, which was what allowed us to have this synergy here this evening. I do want to say, though, that we encourage our elected officials to come to these. It's always good for the finance staffs who are doing this to hear the questions that you offer, and sometimes it may be less threatening to hear it from you than their own council member, if you will. You can kind of get unofficial feedback and advice that way through that interaction. And it's also great for council members to understand the full depth of things that are required for finance officials and the difficulty that they have in just keeping up with the day-to-day, much less getting into the long-term strategies and whatnot. With that, I'll ask if there's any follow-up questions, and again, reiterate, if something comes up down the road, please don't hesitate to shoot me an email.
Mr. Dagan, thank you so much for this great presentation. Really, really do appreciate this. Several of us actually just got back from the TML Small Cities Conference a couple of weeks ago, and we had a finance session as part of that, and it was very, very informative. We've been doing this a while, and we still learned new things that we hadn't known about. The one thing that got asked at the conference that the gentleman wasn't able to answer was about There's a Senate bill that did get approved recently that's causing, I can't remember the exact number, but it's basically limiting the, it's either limiting the deductions that we can claim or something to that effect, but it's a big change that got approved. Do you know the one that I'm talking about?
I don't remember the bill. I think it was 9, but I believe what maybe is being referenced is that there was a change in exemption that businesses could have for what would be exempted business personal property. Okay. Yeah. And prior to the bill going through, I want to say it was a $2,500 limit. Anything that a small business owner valued less than $2,500 was not taxed. They've now bumped that significantly. And I'm not remembering off the top of my head what the new exemption is, but I want to say it was
125,000,
yes. So now saying that everything valued at 125,000 or less is no longer going to be taxable is going to strip a lot of value off of the tax rolls.
That's right.
Yes.
That's the one. Wow. That's the one that I remember.
Yes. I think it was 9, if I remember correctly. But that's one of those that is certainly going to have a potential huge impact for some cities, depending on what their business makeup is.
Yeah. We do have some businesses that
would be impacted
for us.
Yes.
Is that things like that the legislature is doing, does that, or do you anticipate that impacting cities' ability to keep their taxes at a no new revenue tax rate? I mean, it seems like there's lots of different things stripping tax revenue out, taking the ability of the cities to have enough funds to do business on behalf of their citizens.
Correct. I will say this personal opinion. The no new revenue rate sounds great on paper, but it may not be sustainable depending on your community situation. And the reasoning for that is that every year the costs of a city to do business are going up typically anywhere from 3 to 5%. We talk about CPI with a lot of these proposals, but really cities are also dealing with what some people will call a municipal cost index, which is kind of a combination of your CPI, but also some of the things that cities buy fall under the producer price index category or a manufacturing cost category, because in addition to goods and services, we're also buying things like pipe and metal and rock and other things, sand, et cetera, that may not be captured under CPI, and those costs are going to continue to go up. Cities that have that are growing rapidly can do that no new revenue rate because they're getting new value coming on board that is adding additional tax revenues. However, if the other revenues are not keeping up with that, sales tax, fees, et cetera, what you find is revenue growth is less than your expenditure growth, and you're going to have to start cutting into reserves. So there may be years where a no new revenue rate is the appropriate rate, but there may be years where a different rate may also be appropriate if other revenues are not making up that difference.
Thank you.
Yep. Mr. Dagan, thank you so much. We've got to get ready for our next one. We really appreciate it. One more time for Mr. Dagan, please. Thank you. Council, let's take a 5-minute bio break, and let's be back by 5:30. We'll try to start as soon as possible. Thank you.